Hi, this is Claire, and you're listening to Season 3 of the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting and the resources and communities that exist to support families. This show is made possible by the support of Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Mother Love is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. We visit with providers working to support parents and families and highlight the resources and tools they provide to help. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all. Celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love. Hi, Mother Love listeners. I'm here with Stephanie Hackman today. And Stephanie is joining us to share a really beautiful, difficult at times story that has led her to do some incredible work in the world today. So as always, I'm really excited to be here and to be able to talk with you, Stephanie. And I think we'll just start by having you introduce yourself to our listeners and to our audience. And just tell a little bit about what your current life looks like today.
Okay, great. Thanks, Claire. So I'm Stephanie, and I am a mother of 6 children at the moment because I was recently married and my husband also brought 4 children to the table. So with my 2 living children and his 4 living children, we have a total of 6 children in our household now. So it's very busy. Between, you know, things, events for each child. And it seems like each of them go to a different school. And
and then I know that you lived here in Montana, where I am, and it's way too cold today. It was one of those days where it like started off warmer than it got colder throughout the day. And somehow I feel like that's so unfair. I'm always like, wait, it's supposed to warm up during the day. But now you are not living in the cold.
That's right.
Maybe you can tell us about a little bit of the backstory, because I think it's a really fun part of your story of why are you in Texas now?
Yeah. So at the end of last year, I reconnected with, well, I guess it was halfway through last year. I reconnected with my high school sweetheart. Well, we dated in junior high and high school, and he had just recently gotten divorced 4 years ago, and I had recently gotten divorced. And so we started talking for a while and kind of rekindled our affection toward one another. And then in August, we were married back in the small town of Rexburg, Idaho, where we had originally met when we were in junior high. And so we were married there. And then we came to Texas, is where he has lived for the past several years. And so Texas today was 70 degrees.
Oh.
So a little bit muggy, but not freezing.
Yeah. Oh, I love that part of your story so much. And I love that you guys decided to get married in Rexford, Idaho. I just think that that's so, I just love it. I just think that's so special.
Yeah, it was a beautiful rainy day, which I loved because I love the rain. And after we were married, the man who was both of our mutual friends back when we were in junior high. His name's Johnny, and he was there at the wedding. And then afterward, we were walking to the cars, and he's like, you know, I'm going to get in my, on the way home, I'm going to listen to that Alanis Morris set. It's like rain on your wedding day.
Oh, nice.
And so that kind of became like my little love song to myself.
Oh, that's awesome. Nice.
Because it's pretty ironic.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. And then I do think it's important to mention, we'll probably talk about this a little bit more later, but
you're doing some really interesting work right now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with your work life?
Yeah. So I'm a professional counselor. I've been licensed in counseling, working for the past several years in Montana in private practice and doing agency work with kiddos in the school system. And then when I moved to Texas, I found out the standards in Texas are a bit more strict. And so I'm required to get an extra 250 direct hours. And so I am working as a school behavioral health clinical liaison. So I get to go into the schools and kind of advocate for the kiddos who are falling under the radar or who may not be able to make it into the agency to get intake done and some assessments done. So I'm able to kind of bridge that gap for the people who have troubles connecting. I'm still working on a stepping stone toward that process of being able to do what I love the most, which is working with postpartum mental health.
Yeah. Okay. And then I guess the next thing before we really dive into your own personal journey and story of becoming a mom, I'd just love to know, you know, when I asked you to come on the podcast and when you've had other opportunities to share your story, like, what is it that really inspires you or motivates you to share your story with a larger audience?
I would say there are two things. First is for Jonathan, because at the heart of every time that I share my story is so that I share his story, so that he lives. And the second piece is I always think of that nameless mother who's sitting in her room listening to the podcast, or who gets invited to a storytelling event and sits in the back of the rows and hears the story, and it resonates with her that it's a catalyst for change and healing of her own. So
yeah, totally.
Yeah. And for me, it's a therapeutic process, obviously, because there is a lot of health and healing in narration. And in all the in cultures throughout time and in cultures throughout the world, storytelling is an integral part of healing and grieving. So for me, it's something that I gain from it. But then I think of Jonathan and I think of the nameless mother or father.
So. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I agree. And a lot of that is why I've been that mom who has heard a story and who has been kind of rescued by shared experience. So that's also why I get out of bed every day and why I feel so honored to do this work. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk about a little bit about your journey, which is there are so many layers and so many kind of factors that come in when we talk about your journey of becoming a mom. So I know it's kind of hard to say, like, go ahead and just tell this story. But every mom, I think, knows there's like a point in time and a place in your life where you really feel like that your journey started. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to let you decide that. I'm not going to tell you where to begin telling. Mm-hmm. And just if you could kind of tell us about the beginning of that journey. Mm-hmm.
So my journey begins with motherhood. There's a lot that happened before that was able to become a part of my journey, but that's where I like to start my journey because that's where my heart is. Yeah. And so as a new mother, we had started trying in 2003, but I experienced some barriers in my conception. And so it did take 4 years for me to conceive. It's like just over 3 years for me to conceive and about 4 years before we had our first son, Benjamin. And that was in 2007. And so I had gone through a journey of grief in that piece, because I grieved the inability to conceive. I grieved that beautiful piece that I felt like I was born to do, which was to be a mother, the most important job and the only job I ever wanted was to be a mom. And so when I wasn't able to conceive for 4 years, I did go through a period of loneliness and just sadness and so grief. And then I was able to conceive, and I was so happy being pregnant. I remember getting morning sickness for the very first time in my life, and I was elated that I got sick because I got sick, that meant that I was pregnant. And it wasn't just an imaginary event. It wasn't an error in any kind of a test. I was actually pregnant. And then we had always kind of just thrown it out there that about 2 years down the road, like 2 years between kiddos, right, would be the perfect age gap. And so without any difficulty, we got pregnant for our second time. And Jonathan is his name. And he was due in September of 2009. So just almost 2 years after my son was born. And the pregnancy, again, was this beautiful piece. I was so excited to be pregnant. I felt so beautiful. Some things happened to me because my belly was so huge, so it would stick out. People were always convinced that I was carrying twins, but I would get it caught on like doors, and I burned my belly one time trying to drain the water out of noodles, spaghetti noodles.
Oh my God.
And there was a nice burn mark around across the front. And when I went to the doctor, I lifted up my shirt and he just laughed immediately. And he's like, spaghetti?
Really? Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's like a common.
Yeah, I guess that is a shared experience. So he knew away. Yeah, he knew right away how I had done it. And there was this one time I was in the grocery store in Walmart, I think it was. And you know how they have the like carousel of bags on these hooks that stick out, and the woman just like whips it around when you're done to make sure you don't forget it, right? And it caught my belly button. And
no way.
These things never made me feel bad that my belly was huge. It made me feel special. Like, yeah, I felt this earthly connection and this unspoken club that I was a part of when this pregnant woman walks by me and like we glance at each other and like, girl, I know.
So, totally.
So my pregnancy was just beautiful. And I had considered doing a VBAC, a vaginal birth after a cesarean, because I had a C-section with my first son because my blood pressure spiked at the end, the very end. And so they just did a C-section. My first son was 9 pounds, 2 ounces, so a big boy. Mm-hmm. And so I had considered doing a VBAC, but I was too scared. I was too scared that I didn't want to do anything that would jeopardize anything. So we had scheduled a C-section for September 24th, 2009. 3 days before that, we went in for our final ultrasound, and we did do our ultrasound and the heart rate monitor and everything just to be sure everything was perfect. His heart rate was perfect, and you know, he came up fine on the ultrasound and everything's great. And so the morning of the C-section, I remember him kicking around, and I remember turning to my husband at the time and saying, he's really active this morning. And so got ready for the hospital. And we lived in the small town of Conrad, Montana, which is very tiny, about less than 3,000 people. And the hospital was a mile away from our house. And so we drove to the hospital, and I can't remember if I was recording or if my husband was recording. I think he was recording and taking video. And so I remember, you know, just talking about how excited we were as we were driving to the hospital. And we came in through the hospital doors, and the mothering unit, the labor and delivery, consisted of three rooms right around the emergency area. So we walked into the emergency area room, doorway, and then we were brought into one of the three labor and delivery rooms. And they hooked me up to the monitor, got me in my gown and got me hooked up to the monitor. And then they put the goop on the monitor piece, you know, the kind that looks like a belt that straps across the biggest part of your belly. And there's one of those, just like a listening device on it. And so she put it on and she couldn't get it in the right spot. She was struggling with it. And so she tried for a good 2 or 3, 5 minutes maybe. And then she's like, I gotta go get a different one. This one's not working. So she left the room and then she came back in with a new one and she hooked it up. And again, she couldn't find the heartbeat. And so she's like, you know, I'm gonna go get the ultrasound to bring it in. He's going to have so much easier time getting it because they've got a machine. So she leaves. And I remember it was a bit of time, maybe 10, 15 minutes. And he came in with the ultrasound machine. And in those 10 minutes between the time that she left and he came in was the first time I considered that something, what if something were to go wrong. At the time, though, I didn't believe that something could go wrong. Like, not to me. Yeah. It happens to other people. So not to me. So by the time he came in, I remember him getting hooked up. And I remember turning to him and asking him, you would tell me if something was wrong, right? Like, you would tell me. And he didn't respond. He just giggled kind of nervously, like, remember, or that's what I remember. And so I remember thinking, that's not a good sign because he didn't answer my question. Right. And so he hooked it up and he tried for about 15 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh. And so he was new. He was newer, a newer ultrasound tech. He just barely started the job recently. So that was kind of a comfort to me. Just thinking, I'm sure that this is an ultrasound technician who doesn't quite know what he's doing yet. So I'm sure my doctor will be able to figure this out. And so
straighten this out. Yeah.
Right. And so, he, after about 15 minutes says, you know, I'm going to go get the doctor because I'm just having a hard time, but I'm sure he'll be able to figure this out. So he leaves to go get the doctor, and someone who was in the room at the time, a family member, turned to me and said, I just feel like I should tell you that fear is false evidence appearing real. And I think she meant that as a comfort. However, it did not comfort me in that moment. Yeah. I was terrified by the time the doctor came in, and I remember my body was doing things that I wasn't used to. I was shaking uncontrollably, and that I'd never experienced things like that before. And I remember telling my doctor, I can't stop shaking. And I don't know if I wanted him to like fix it, or if like I was asking him if something was wrong with me, why I couldn't stop shaking. Like maybe I was going, you know, something was wrong with my body. But all he said was, I know. And in that second, I was like, of course you would be shaking. And so it was a comfort. And so
to be acknowledged like that. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so then he sat on the edge of the bed and he put the monitor on my stomach. This time it was like one of the wands, and he put the monitor on my stomach for about 30 seconds. And he pressed it, and he was a very exceptional doctor. He was great at what he did as a family practitioner. He was also trained as an anesthesiologist. He knew ultrasounds. He was an exceptional doctor. And about 30 seconds go by and I'm watching the little tiny, it's a little black and white screen, probably no bigger than a cell phone, maybe a large cell phone, but just probably no bigger than that. But I remember seeing these like posts, these white posts, and the doctor pointed at him with his finger and he said, "Do you see these right here?" And he's pointing at these posts. It's like light and dark, black and white. And he said, "They look like prison bars." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Those are his ribs." And then he hovered over a little black dot right behind the ribs. And he said, "And you see this right here?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "That's his heart." And I said, "And it's not beating?" And he said, "It is not." And that was the moment that I found out that my son had died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. I mean, like you said, like what an exceptional doctor to have the understanding that you at that moment, like you didn't need anyone to skirt around anything. You needed information and you needed someone to tell you the truth.
Yes.
and I think that that is something that is really rare in those situations because people, even if it's their job to care for their patient, people are so uncomfortable in those moments that they often don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. So they don't say anything. And that's what you had been experiencing up until that moment.
Yes.
And so I imagine that as hard as that was, it was also really important that he was so straight with you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you share just more about what that was like after that moment?
Yes. So after that moment, well, actually, I remember that he explained the news to us, and in the room, it was filled with some people that I knew, some people that I didn't know. There was the doctor and the ultrasound technician. There were two nurses. And then there were several students. I want to say three students. Maybe some were nurses. Some were student physicians. People I had never met before. And on one side of the room. The other side of the room, there were two or three family members and two or three members of an oppressive religious organization that I was a part of during the time. And so I started crying immediately and I started going over the events of the past few days and recounting out loud. But we had just seen his heart, but nothing had come up, but he was alive this morning. And I remember that piece. And then the doctor, you know, he just was so caring and just, "I'm going to let you have some time." And he left. And I do remember the first thing that I did was turn to my spouse at the time and say that I was sorry. So immediately guilt came in and rested. Yeah. And the guilt didn't leave for several years.
Yeah.
Maybe the guilt hasn't quite left all the way yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that part of the party left the room and the doctor, before he left, he said that the danger of rupture is over. And so now we just need to decide if we want to do a C-section or do a vaginal birth, because the danger of rupture was over, meaning that the risk of vaginal birth after C-section is due to the possibility of a rupture happening and causing harm to the baby. And since there was no living baby, there was no risk. So, and everything within me wanted to do a vaginal birth, because in some way, in some magical way, I thought that what a beautiful way to bring my son into the world, to give him this last gift. Mm-hmm. And when he left, I knew that as a member of this oppressive religious organization, I wasn't able to make a decision like that on my own, and I needed to get permission from the leader. And so after the door shut, when the doctor left the room, I turned to the leader and I said, now we just have to decide if we will have a VBAC or continue with the C-section. And he said, you'll do a C-section. And so when the doctor came back in and he asked us what we had decided, I said I would do a C-section. And so immediately things went into motion.
Yeah. Why do you think that he, like, why do you think that the leader made that call as opposed to the other?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a few reasons. First of all, I think that this particular person has had an issue with power, and so that he made the decisions in each of the members of this oppressive religious organization's lives. And then the other piece is because this particular leader was very focused on notoriety and having some kind of a quote unquote miracle happen so that he would get recognition. And so what he said he believed was that the women of the organization would go into one of the other three labor and delivery rooms and begin praying. And then if we did a C-section, it's possible that the baby could come out alive, and then all of the world would see this miracle that happened.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And so his expectation was that this would bring him some recognition.
Yeah. Did you, because you knew that that was his belief, was there a hope that resided in you that that could be a possibility?
So I was part of this. This, by definition, Robert J. Lifton is an expert on cults and mind control. And according to his definition of a cult, this organization meets the criteria of a cult. And so this is how I'll refer to it from now on, is this cult. This cult had specific belief systems set up. And the way that they enforced these beliefs onto people was to use coercion, fear, and kind of threatening. And so this was a tactic that was used to control me in that moment. So I was controlled by fear that if I didn't choose to go on with a C-section, then God couldn't do the miracle and it would be my fault that my son died and didn't be raised back to life. If that makes sense.
So it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just curious how you felt at that moment, because it's such a hard reality to accept that. I was curious, I guess, about your experience in that moment, whether you were able to hold on to hope that maybe that miracle could take place, or if you just, as a mother who had just seen her baby without the heartbeat, if you just innately knew that that wouldn't happen.
So I think that if you were to ask any mother who receives the news that her child is dead, that they are in disbelief for quite some time. Yeah. So in that time period, I was also in disbelief. And so if there were any way that I could turn back time and go back to the day before when he was still alive, and say that I demand a C-section this day instead of this day, I think there's a part of me that still has never even let go of that possibility.
Yeah, I bet.
So I would do anything to make him alive.
Totally. Of course. So. Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah. And think about how impressionable a person is when and vulnerable in that situation. So coercion is not difficult when someone is vulnerable.
Hello, Mother Love listeners. We have a favor to ask. We created a survey because we would like to know what your experience has been as a listener of Mother Love. Have things been helpful? Are there topics that you'd like to hear more about? Just any feedback you might have that can help us to grow and become better, we would love to hear. The survey is located at hmhb-mt.org/podcast. And if you just take a moment to go on over to the survey, it's on the landing page, the Mother Love landing page, and it should only take a handful of minutes. So please answer the questions. And then there's a place also for you to just share like an open-ended response about what it's been like and what Mother Love has meant to you. So thank you so much. We look forward to hearing from you.
Coming out of that experience and what was available to you in terms of healing or even just trying to live with what had just happened, you were really limited in what you could use to get help for that. And you were really limited in what even you could understand was happening within you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So because I was a member of this cult, the idea of seeking outside counseling or help was very frowned upon. And because I wasn't able to get the help I needed, I did end up developing PTSD as a result. I had become pregnant again 4 months after that day. 4 months afterward, with no planning or trying, I became pregnant with my son Elijah, who is now 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I was incredibly happy to be pregnant and also still very, very sad. And so yeah. I think that battle internally between feeling this incredible emptiness, but then also this incredible joy, I think that mm-hmm. battle was what led to increased levels of anxiety and what would be postpartum stress or disorder and PTSD.
Yeah.
Because, and I think that in PTSD, the best way to treat PTSD is immediate exposure to the stressor and immediate help. The sooner you get help, the less likely you are to develop PTSD. So the research shows. So when I got pregnant with Elijah, I went to the same doctor, the same hospital, the same room, the same doctor, the same nurse. And so it did help me through my journey. However, I was terrified. I was so scared to be pregnant. The fear that I went through during that period of my life, I can't describe. It's the deepest, darkest place I've been in my life. And I would have panic attacks daily. So the yeah. issue was that the members of this cult believed that fear was a sin. And I was told that I would be, because I had fear in such a way, that they would use biblical scripture as a method of control. One of the verses that they used was the fearful and the unbelieving will find themselves in the lake of fire, something with the angel and or with the devil and all of his demons. And it's something to that effect. I'm misquoting it, but people who are afraid and people who do not believe belong in the same place that the devil does, which is burning in hell. And I was so afraid and also doubting everything. And so I was not able to talk about the anxiety to people because it was actually a sin. And so my spouse at the time and I weren't able to talk about this because it was a hidden sin. And so I remember there were times where there was this one time where I was actually having a panic attack on our bed and I was shaking uncontrollably. And my spouse at the time thought that I was cold. So they went and got me a blanket and said, "Oh, you're cold." And I wasn't able to tell them, actually, I'm having a panic attack. And
oh my gosh.
So it was a kind of a hidden secret. It was a secret and a shameful, because I was ashamed that I wasn't able to be a model person in this cult who wouldn't let something like fear control them. So
man, that's so tough.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. And I'm so sorry that you went through that. That must have felt really lonely.
Yes, absolutely. Very yeah. lonely. There was nobody that I could tell what was actually going on.
Yeah.
And so there was a time about 3.5 years after Jonathan died that a person in the cult came up to me and told me that I had a spirit of grief on my shoulder, that I had kind of contracted a spirit of grief, and that it wasn't allowing me to get over the loss of my son, and that I needed to get rid of that spirit, and that something that I was doing was keeping it there. So,
gosh, just the amount of self-blame, mm-hmm. like you said,
it was pretty difficult, especially since it started, you know, at the moment of finding out that right. Jonathan had died, and then it was quite a long journey. So then in 2017 is when we did end up exiting the cult together, my husband at the time and my two sons and I. And what ultimately led to that decision was consistent stripping of free will and the right to make choices on our own. There, if you can think of every area of a person's life, every area of a person's life is controlled within that cult. And what was happening is the method of control was anger, threats, and coercion. And so sometimes these would come out in aggression and raising voices and yelling at me, at my spouse and I, in front of our children. Mm-hmm. And so I just remember thinking that this is not a way that I want to raise up my children, and I can't continue to do this, because yeah. it wasn't about me at that point. It was about my children. And so my children are 14 or 15 and 12 now, and they still remember that happening.
Yeah.
They remember people yelling at us.
Mm-hmm.
So it did affect them in a way. Of course it affected them. And then after we left the cult, it was kind of this period of reclaiming ourselves, because everything that had happened during that time period was strategically done to strip away our identity and mm-hmm. to mold us into the image of what that cult wanted to project.
Right.
And so the Stephanie that loved wishing on the first star she saw in the middle of the night, or, you know, like picked up a dandelion and blew off the little and made a wish, or wished on like a four-leaf clover, that Stephanie who believed in the magic of every day
yeah.
was squashed to the point where yeah. I had almost forgotten who I was. And yeah. so about a year after I left the cult, I decided that that it was time for my journey to for myself to reclaim myself in my journey. And so part of that was in connecting to myself and my body, because the thing that had started presenting itself was stress and its acute effect on the physiology of the body. And so that's how the trauma kind of presented itself in within me. So for a long time in this cult, I ignored the warning signs that my body set off. So there were times where certain things would happen and I would feel this like kind of a little glimmer, like a warning sign, like that doesn't feel right. And I had been conditioned to ignore the warning signs, so that eventually the warning signs were huge, but I had been so conditioned to ignore the tiniest ones that by the time they were huge, I was just ignoring them.
Yeah.
And they were life-changing things that I had learned to ignore. And so that's what I started doing. And I had the help of this beautiful, feeling wonderful person. I don't know if I can say her name on the podcast.
Jamie, okay, let's say it. You're not the first guest to talk about great. Jamie and Isi. We can say it.
So Jamie and Isi. So I always thought that if I ever wrote my story as like an allegory, she would be like a moonbeam or something totally. Like something like magical and like glimmering and like a hope in the darkness, right? And so yeah. Jamie the Moonbeam, Moonchild, yes. Jamie.
I think that's how most people feel about Jamie. If you've met Jamie and Isi, you understand that mm-hmm. she is a rare mm-hmm. light in this world.
Yes.
And that's just true.
And yeah. I stumbled upon her and I was able to work through my healing journey with her walking beside me. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I would say the biggest, okay, I can't categorize it, but one of the most life-changing things that she helped me to do was to remember to love myself. Yeah. So in every warning sign that came off in my body, it was this opportunity to hear myself again and to love myself and to have compassion for myself. And in so doing, I was able to step past the pain that had been caused and, you know, as if I were a flower that was like wilted, but not dead yet. And she was able to teach me how to nurture myself again and come out of that pain and experience with a story to tell. And
because not only were you taught to ignore, conditioned to ignore your intuition and your signals and your bodily sensations, but you were taught that having them was fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
And like actually like really, really bad. Mm-hmm. So like, was there a point in time where it was like felt really scary to do that work? And then as you went along, it got easier. You know, was it really scary at first to like give yourself attention and compassion in that way? Or did it just feel so good from the beginning?
No, it was terrifying. It was so scary. And Jamie knew that. I know that she knew that as we were doing the work. And so I think she would address it in a way that celebrated the strength that I was demonstrating. So the tiniest of strengths were celebrated. And once that became normal, then my strength became bigger, right? Yeah. And so then that strength was celebrated. So it was scary because it was a long time that I was part of that organization. 14 years.
Was your family, was your extended family also a part of this cult, or did you have a support system that existed outside of it?
Yep. So my family was not part of the cult. The people that were part of this cult invited me to go, and I had never met them prior to that. But the interesting thing is the individual that would invite me would become very close to me in the future. And what I found out in years later was that there had been discussion about arranging a marriage for me before I came into the cult. And then a kind of a matchmaking situation leading up to my joining the cult. So if you can imagine, I don't know if you have ever heard of any of the things that have gone on in Scientology, but there's been some kind of discussion about members of that organization kind of putting in line events that would lead to certain people coming together. So it's not an outright matchmaking situation, but it's they kind of like put this event here and this event and this event that would lead these two people together. And then what eventually ended up happening was that when my ex-spouse and I had come together, these members of this cult had told us that they already knew long before we knew, because God, quote unquote, had told them that we would be married a long time ago. And so just even that I met my spouse in the way that I did was actually already arranged for me before I had set foot into the organization.
Wow. That's so interesting and so deceptive.
It really is deceptive. And ultimately, I think my ex-spouse and I divorced last year. And part of the understanding we both came to is that after we left the cult, we both went on our own journeys to kind of rediscover who we were. I was 21 when I came into the cult, and so I had a pretty good understanding of who I was and what pieces of myself they had strategically kind of squashed out. However, my spouse was very young, pre-teen years, and so they had some I feel like they had a greater journey.
I know what you're saying.
But they had to go back farther in themselves to rediscover who they were. Mm-hmm. So probably 2/3 or more of their life was spent in the cult, whereas just maybe like 1/3 of mine. In their journey, they discovered some things about themselves. And in my journey, I discovered some things about myself. And then we both had to face this idea that we were, in effect, living in a modern day arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And so whose choice was it to come together? Were we still compatible? And did we see ourselves walking together on our journeys, or had our paths kind of diverted into two individual paths? And what we ultimately found out is that they had diverted. And so in 2022, we did end up stepping into our own journeys and our paths separated then. And that's when I reconnected with my former sweetheart. And actually, when I had come into the cult, I had just stepped away from an engagement to my current husband.
Really?
Yes. So we had been engaged. So we had been engaged. And actually, at the time, he was a member of a religious group where he went on, let's say, like a mission.
This is like the best. This is the best unorthodox love story ever. Like, I want to see the rom-com slash, like, drama and suspense thriller about your love story.
I don't know if I've ever seen a rom-com suspense thriller, but this would be the first.
I heard that Hallmark is looking to switch up their storyline.
So I'll pitch the idea to them. So he was on this religious trip that would last about 2 years, and while he was gone was when the cult came into and had done this arranging, and I ended up getting married. By the time he came back from his trip, I was already married.
Wow.
And so he talks to me now about the period of his life after that, when he came home and realized that there was absolutely no way that we could be together, that he went through a low period in his life. And so,
Yeah, that was a big loss for him, I'm sure, you know.
And we don't look at it with regret because we have 6 beautiful children from two marriages. It just so happened that neither of our marriages were what would become what we are together. So it kind of worked out for us in the end.
Totally. Well, and you had said that the two of you spoke about, you know, no matter what had happened, had you ended up together like you are today or not, you knew each other at a time in life that is so, like, that just so shapes fundamentally who we are as people, that you would always be a part of each other's stories. And I think that there are a lot of people who know that feeling of connection, whether it's a really beautiful friendship or whether it's, you know, you were, when you grow with someone like that, there just isn't, it just doesn't go away. It's a part of your story. You know, you find out who you are through these relationships when you are that age, and that's important. And it's something that you got back in so many ways. And that's why it's such a favorite part of your story. I love it.
And when we reconnected, there was just this, I can honestly say that part of our journey coming back together has helped me reconnect with who I was even further. And so my journey has been so hard at times. Just coming away and remembering who I am and struggling through these, struggling past this, these, you know, this thought stopping procedures that the cult had kind of trained us to do, and to like trust my own voice, trust my own needs, trust my body knows me, trust the signals that it gives me on a day-to-day basis, trust my intuition again, and trust the connections that I have with people and with myself.
And you know what's so beautiful about that is, like, now that probably makes you a really wonderful partner and wife. It makes you a really, really beautiful, attuned mother. And it equips you to do this work with children and advocating for them in ways that would just totally go over other people's heads. Like, you, it's so, I don't know. It's hard because we never want to, like, say, yay, I'm so glad I went through all that traumatic, hard stuff. But sometimes it does turn into this skill set that is, like, super duper rare and can be so effective and help so many other people learn to love themselves in ways that, you know, are really, really powerful. So I think and when you work in, you know, you're ultimately, you are planning, I know, to specifically work with perinatal mental health and moms in this period. And just the amount of empathy and compassion and comfort that you have going to those hard spaces with people is, again, like, it's something that's really hard earned and hard won, you know. And you, yes, you can learn that when you go to school, but when you're in a room with someone who's grieving, like, if you've also been to the depths of grief, then you are their person. You know, so I just think it's incredible.
I do think that it gives me kind of a superpower. I like to think of it that way, that it gives me the ability to empathize with them in such a place of strength, to know what it is to grieve someone that you love, to know what it is to feel your freedoms being stripped away. So individuals who've experienced great loss in their life, individuals who've gone through domestic violence. Yeah, I find that I can bring to the table something that just has like a true depth and meaning. So that transparency of this real lived experience. And I've always been open with my clients about some of the journey that I've gone through, because for someone to know what it's like to grieve is such a comfort and a peace that just brings people together. So that nameless person in the back of the room who hears my story, it might give her the strength to share her own story, to begin that healing process. And I believe that the healing process begins with sharing your story with someone. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think counseling or storytelling, narrative therapy is really valuable, because you are giving yourself your voice to share your experience after your voice has been taken away. Grief takes your voice, right? Abuse, coercion, domestic violence, it takes your voice away. And so reclaiming that is one of the strongest things, strongest gifts I think a person can give themselves.
Yeah, agreed. And when we're in the throes of any of those things, like you said, it's so hard to even believe that there's a possibility of getting out of such an impossible situation or an impossible feeling. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing with storytelling, is like when we are able to witness someone who is on the other side of what we're like just completely in the middle of, it does offer hope that like, okay, this person was in this hard of a place as well. And now they've healed so much that they're healing other people. Mm-hmm. And like, that's so hopeful, if, you know, for people to know that like, it's not like you're going to suddenly become like a polished product that mm-hmm. never went through anything hard. It's more that you'll be able to, through healing, you'll be able to develop, like you said, like a superpower mm-hmm. that only belongs to those who like walk through the fire of this kind of process. Mm-hmm. And storytelling is one of the bravest ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And the, you know, it's not that I'm in the place now where my body doesn't give me warning signals or I don't have anxiety sometimes. Sometimes I do feel my body giving me those signals. It's kind of like, if you think of it as a little girl, like my little self, my young Stephanie, like tugging at my pant leg, like, are we okay? Like, are you all right? Is this okay? Like, are you sure we're going to be okay? And then you scooping up that little girl and, you know, just like rubbing her back and telling her we're going to be okay. So my body does still come up to me and give me signals like, you know, that just catch in my throat. Like, is this okay? And then I do still continue. But the thing that I don't do anymore is to ignore it.
Yeah. And then one last thing mm-hmm. before we wrap up mm-hmm. is I'd love for you to talk about what writing has done for you. Mm.
So writing for me has been the most therapeutic thing that I've done in my entire journey. So I was a writer before I became a mother, before I was a member of a cult, before I was divorced, before I was a woman in my 40s, I was a writer. And now I am a divorced mother of a stillborn child, ex-cult member, 41-year-old woman who is a writer. And so that piece of me that was kind of put on hold for a 14-year period has reunited with herself. And so she is about telling her story in all the different ways that she can, with different means and methods and bringing a voice to my experience. So I have done short pieces of work that I've had published, and I'm currently working on longer memoir of my journey. So
awesome.
Yeah. Yes. And I continue my journey by reading other works of women who have gone through, or individuals, sometimes men, sometimes women, sometimes in between, of humans sharing their stories of what they've gone through in their lives. And one that we recently discussed, you and I, was it Joan Didion? Is her name Joan?
Joan Didion.
And so I did read
The Year of Magical Thinking.
And yeah. So
you did in like 1 week.
Actually, I read it and I listened to the audiobook after I read it so that I could really soak in the words that she uses.
Isn't she amazing? Yeah.
And so my work isn't published yet, but Joan Didion's is. So if anybody really wants to like step into the heart of storytelling as a method of grieving and therapeutic healing, then Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking is a good piece to go to.
It's astounding. It's astounding.
And so some of the words that she said, my printer's connected to someone's phone, so they decided now is a good time. So
this is a mom podcast.
Okay, great. Okay, so a kiddo has homework. I know that's what's going on. Yeah. So The Year of Magical Thinking, some of the words that she said in her book, I have written, and I found that incredible, because Joan Didion went through her experience. It's such a different time in history than I did. Her experience was completely different than mine was. But the words that came out of her mouth, the experience that the feelings that she felt, I had written those things. One of the strongest things she said is that healing comes in waves. And I'm not going to lie, I thought I invented the word.
Yeah, but that's so beautiful because it's universal.
It's such a universal piece. And so I am a lifelong learner. And reading her story, it was just a reminder that I'm not alone. Yeah. This woman, she has passed on now, and so I'll never meet her. But wow, what an experience to learn from. And I feel like we could have had a nice cup of coffee together and talked about our experience together.
Yeah. Have you watched the documentary? Have you done all your Joan Didion homework? So the documentary on Netflix about her life. If you haven't seen it yet, did you watch it?
No, I didn't, because I didn't want to watch it until I was done reading. Yeah, okay. So I then stepped into the blue book that she wrote.
Blue Nights?
Yeah, Blue Nights, which is the kind of a story about her daughter and her experience and grief through that. So I'm not quite done with that,
When you're done with that, because the cool thing about that documentary is you will feel like you're having a cup of coffee with her.
Okay, great.
Like, it's very intimate and it's very well done. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I'm glad that,
The question that they ask, if you could have a cup of coffee with one person in history, or with somebody in history, living or dead, who would it be? Mary Oliver is
me
my
too.
Person. Is it?
Mary Oliver is my hero.
Yes.
Joan Didion's really close on that list.
Joan Didion is on my list now. So yes, Mary Oliver. She her writing helped me through the darkest part of my grief. So
Because she went through a lot of her own darkness. And Mary Oliver, definitely. Okay, so now I have to bring up one more since we're nerding out on authors. But have you read anything by Matt Haig yet?
No.
So it's MATTHAIG, Matt Haig. And he's a novelist, but he also has written recently a few books that are like some of the most accurate accounts of depression or anxiety. Like, the way that he writes about those things is like, it just is so spot on. Mm-hmm. And he's one of my people that I also would like to have a cup of coffee with.
I'll have to do some research. The Mother Love podcast, put on by, I think, New York Times maybe,
or it has to be one, because this is Mother Love, so it's probably called Is it called something slightly different?
Modern Love.
Okay. I was like, wait a minute. Thank you for promoting the podcast on the podcast.
So there's the Modern Love podcast, and they've done some video shorts like that. And there was this one that I happened to stumble across where Anne Hathaway portrayed this woman who had bipolar disorder, and she hid that from everyone in her life. But there was this piece where, you know, these are based on essays turned in by actual people, which is what I love the most about it. But there's this portrayal where she shows what it's like to kind of be helpless against depression when it sets in. And it's the most accurate depiction of depression I've ever seen before, where it just comes on like a heavy weight and just like kind of like sits you back down. And so I'd be really interested to see what Matt Haigs has to say about depression.
Yeah.
I have experienced depression postpartum, not postpartum depression, but depression afterward, but not postpartum depression, but just that feeling.
Yeah. So. Yeah. His two books are called Reasons to Stay Alive and The Comfort Book. Those are the two that are really about his journey with mental health, and they're good. So anyway, okay, well, I'm glad, glad we got to just nerd out on writers and writing for a minute there.
Yes. But
I am really grateful. You know, I don't know if you can share with listeners where they can find your writing that's been published, but I'm really grateful that you shared it with me and that I was able to read it. It's really beautifully done.
Okay.
So is there a place that we can send people?
So we'll have a link that I'll send you afterward. And then they'll be able to access that.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. I really appreciate just you, the work you do, who you are, and for coming on and sharing your story.
Yes.
With us.
And likewise, Claire, because you're providing an atmosphere where we can come and share. So thank you and the Mother Love podcast for inviting me on today. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening today. Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. We encourage you to visit our statewide online resource guide at hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Finally, we extend a warm thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom, and she gets it, and for that, we are so grateful.